time now for the College Football Inquirer with Dan Wetzel.
This is the closest game I've ever seen that wasn't like the last second play.
Pete Thamel.
Sully, can you name this podcast Three Men Yell at Cloud, Death to Analytics?
Yes.
With SI's Pat Forty.
There are more talented teams out there. There's better teams, but you're going to have to bring it for 60 minutes to beat those guys.
Here's Pat, Pete, and Dan.
Hi, welcome to the pod. Pat Forty, we're going to go right to you. Is it true your rental car was flipped over and destroyed in East Lansing? And is it also true when you got back to your hotel that the mattress was gone, burning in the street? Did that happen, Pat Forty? Did Michigan State fans know it was you?
Fake news. Real news that somebody's car was flipped over, vandalized, and had the windshield kicked in, but it was not mine. Myself and my VW Touareg that smelled like Brussels sprouts that I rented from the Detroit airport survived unharmed. Although sitting in a car that stunk that bad for as long as it took to drive to East Lansing and back was not blessed.
If you peek inside the soul of Michigan State, there's a little bit of West Virginia. Just a little bit. There's a little bit of a couch on fire if you look hard.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you need an MRI. Yeah. If you get an MRI,
I don't
Michigan
think you
State
have to
soul.
Look far. You just see the glowing flames in the street.
You just have to
street.
Open up Twitter.
It's right there, right outside the stadium.
I don't understand the concept of burning things when you win.
I don't either.
I don't really get it when you lose. But I can conceptualize just being so angry that you're like, screw it. I'm going to burn my old couch or my mattress so I have nowhere to sleep. All right. You've just blind rage. But when you win, what is it?
I have no idea. Makes less than no sense. As I said in my column, a special kind of stupid. You know, I just don't get it.
I actually feel bad for Michigan State. As a school and the many, many alums. I have tons of friends who are alums, relatives. I have a nephew up there now. I have nieces and nephews gone there. So many co-workers we've all had. It's a great school. And there's one thing Michigan State student and alum spends like half their time is like, we're just as good as the other schools. We're not just a party school, not this wild place, not a safety school. And then they have this big day. This exciting, I mean, Pat and I were both there. The crowd was just phenomenal. And this is in a driving rain and not a, you know, beautiful day and the parties and the spirit of Michigan State and this incredible victory. It was all there. And then all the headlines in the videos are of these bunch of idiots deciding they're going to turn over cars, smash them. And you go, yeah, I wonder how you got that rep. Just because you can't just say we're the other schools when nobody else does this except West Virginia for some bizarre reason. Like Tennessee got a lot of heat a couple weeks ago and they threw crap on the field and they deserved it. But other people also throw stuff on the field sometimes. But nobody flips a car and destroys it in victory. And then you sit there and go, yeah, explain that little cultural tick you've got there, Michigan State. Because I'm with you until things are burning in the courtyard.
Yeah. People are just watching other people kick the windshield into a car.
Whose car?
Yeah.
This poor guy.
And they should be they've beaten Michigan, what? Because Harbaugh's what, 3-4?
10 of the last 15 times.
Yeah. Like, this isn't like this like novel once a generation thing. Like, they have been consistently beating them.
Yeah. It is mind-boggling how somebody decides that's how I'm going to celebrate. I am so happy that I am going to help tip over this car and then sit there and watch other people kick in the windshield or perhaps just personally kick in the windshield. And then, yes, let's go light things on fire. It's different.
Everything's going to be on video. You know what I mean? Like any knucklehead who's kicking in a windshield is going to end up getting suspended or expelled because the school's going to be embarrassed.
Arrested. Yeah, they arrested like, people.
Surely. Yeah.
No, I don't understand. It's a weird concept. And it's too bad because it absolutely is like that's the reputation that the school spends all its time fighting against. And then even on their best days when everyone's paying attention and you know, you go, oh, it's just a few kids. It is just a few kids. Just a few of this. Nobody's seeing all the kids go to class on Monday. They're watching you know, this is the stuff that's on national TV. So just sucks for the school. But I don't know why for decades now this has been the tradition at that place. They'd be well served to defeat that tradition.
Yeah. And that, like you said, on the best day, this is like one of the best of days. You know, the best since they won the Big Ten championship in 2015. You're undefeated. You're in the top 10. Michigan's undefeated. Michigan's in the top 10 in your stadium. As Dan said, the atmosphere was incredible. You fall behind by 16 points. You're about ready to get run out of your own stadium. And then you come back and win that game, and you're 8-0 sitting there. And, I mean, we'll see where they're going to be ranked by the playoff selection committee. They're number 5 with the AP. I think they should be higher than that. And, I mean, that was a great day Saturday.
About this game, 37-33, yeah. Michigan State. Michigan State erases a 16-point second-half deficit. Pat and I were sitting there next to each other. And how many times, I would say, if I didn't say it 5 times at least, where I said, if this play goes this way, Michigan's got it. The tipping point play, there were at least 5. And on all 5 of them, if not more, maybe there were about 7 to 10, another guy said to me, Michigan State made the play or Michigan didn't make the play. Like, it was so close to Michigan winning. There were also 7 video reviews. They all went Michigan State's way.
That's
now, I'm not saying they're wrong, although, some of them are real close. But when you go 7-0, you don't get one of those, just go your other. This is the closest game I've ever seen that wasn't like the last second play. Like they threw the Hail Mary or the 10th overtime, whatever. Like, Michigan could have won this game, I would say, on 5 to 7 different plays and all 7 calls, maybe, or at least 5 of those, Michigan wins. And they might curb stomp them. I mean, that Hutchinson fumble recovery in the end zone, I mean, that was a huge play. And it's like, the guy's ankle bone is just, and, you know, there were catches. It was just above the blade of grass. And the 2-point conversion that you and I both thought, man, I don't think that, you know, I think the Michigan kid took it away. It's just everything went. And credit to Michigan State. They made the winning plays and won this game. But what a heart wreck for Michigan. Like, these coaches have got to be just staring at that film today going, how the hell did we lose?
Oh, that's a tough watch if you're a Michigan coach. Yeah, looking at the film of that. Because you are right. I mean, this was the absolute cliche game of inches, you know, 1 inch this way, 1 inch that way on so many different things. And everything just came up just right enough for Michigan State. And they made a lot of great plays too. I mean, they really did. Like the 4th and 4 throw Peyton Thorne made when they threw the fly pattern to Jaden Reed and he just dropped it in there perfectly. And Reed was sensational on that drive. You know, that was when they're down 16 and they're about out of the game. And they just kept making plays to get down the field, and then they score, and then they get the 2, and then they score, and then they get the 2. And as Penn State and Illinois showed us, it's hard to get 2 points sometimes in the Big Ten, but they did it twice. I mean, that was one of those games where, if you're a Michigan fan or a Michigan player or a Michigan coach, you will be nauseous thinking about that game for a long time.
Kenny Walker III gets the highlights and deserves it. Heisman campaign, 197, 5 TDs, scored all their TDs. Incredible. But that game was won with grit. It had flash, and that's why it's such a great game. Go ahead, Pete.
So let me ask you this. I wasn't there. Obviously, you guys were there. I watched on TV. Unbelievable, compelling theater. I know Pat called it the game of the year in college football. It'd be really hard to argue that notion. So watching from afar, and I texted Dan this at one point, how much of this do you put on Harbaugh? Like, I really thought like the substitution at the goal line and their inability to adjust to the tempo was something that was coaching. Now, again, there were a million things and a million variables, but a game of that many inches, it seemed like there was no adjustment to try to contain Walker, that especially in the goal line, they couldn't adjust their defense. So I'm curious, you were there. I don't know if either of you saw Harbaugh.
They got caught with the sub pattern. Tucker ran them early on the subs. They adjusted to that. I mean, it's hard. So I have two theories on this. One is like a video review goes this way, or the ball is thrown 1 millimeter below someone's feet, or, you know, how much can you put on coaching when you've got that? But at the same time, when, like I said, 10 to 12 variables in the game all went against you, is that coaching? You know, I mean, I don't know. The Michigan team played hard. Mm-hmm. They're good. They threw the ball. I mean, J.J. McCarthy just drops the ball. Like, is that coaching? You don't put him in the game. Well,
that was one thing that I didn't understand from afar, and I didn't watch the game unimpeded. Yeah, like, what do you, like, and McNamara was playing well, I thought.
So with the McCarthy thing, they had subbed him in a couple plays here and there, and I thought fairly effectively. You know, McCarthy had a good run. I think he had one throw. A little bit of a change of pace guy. You're looking at him differently, much more as a run threat than McNamara. So you got to think a little differently. And as Dan pointed out during the game, you're keeping two quarterbacks happy. But second half of that game, at that point, when McNamara is playing as well as he is, and they subbed him in then, and it was very interesting in the Michigan post game. Somebody threw Harbaugh a lifeline while asking the question about why McCarthy was in there. They said, was Cade, you know, physically able to go? And Harbaugh accepted the lifeline, said he was working through some stuff at that point. And I don't know about that. Now, he got blasted on a play, on a great zone blitz by Michigan State, a great call. And he got rung up hard. But then he came back the next series. There was a long Michigan State series, and then there was a long Michigan series that McNamara was in and led them down for the go-ahead field goal. And then McCarthy comes in when they've got the lead with, you know, halfway through the fourth quarter, and that's when that play happened. So I don't think it was a physical thing. I think it was, we're going change of pace here, and it blew up badly on him.
It's hard to say, you know, it's hard to say. It just was so many. I mean, how about a second crushing loss, Michigan to Michigan State, where there's trouble with the snap, right? Like that play. Like they're at fourth. Yeah. They're about, I remember I said they were at fourth and one. I said, if they get the first down, I think Michigan's got this game. And instead they get a false start. Then they punt. He bobbles the ball. Then he's running. The punter runs. He's almost got it, but doesn't. Like so many, it just was a crazy game. Mel Tucker's team, though, is so resourceful. That they never blinked, man. They never blinked at what was going on. They were getting smoked in certain phases of the game. They couldn't block the defensive line on passing. There was a stretch where Kenny Walker couldn't run.
Yeah.
It was a lot of, and they just keep coming. You know, this chopping wood. I wrote in my column, it's like, I roll your eyes and laugh at these stupid phrases until you watch it work. And you're like, chopping wood. Let's do it.
Yep. Like Thorne is he's a good quarterback. He's not like a guy you look at and say he's going to be an NFL star. Jaden Reed is not a big guy, but those two guys have got something special there, and they've been playing together since middle school. Their ability to make plays together, and then Kenneth Walker has got something special too. You know, and they've just kind of coalesced the offense around those guys. And then they brought in a bunch of transfers on defense, and they're making plays for them. Yeah, they've got enough guys, and then they just keep damn chopping. You know, it's pretty remarkable.
So let me ask you this: you've now seen Michigan State live, both of you. Pat, you were up there for a feature, and were around the program, and have a good feel for them. Can Michigan State beat both Penn State and Ohio State?
I thought all along that Ohio State's the most talented team in the Big Ten and should win the Big Ten. But I also see, like Ohio State, and Pete, you were there, right, at the Horseshoe Saturday night. So I was not, obviously, but I was watching Ohio State thinking, why aren't they winning this game by 21 points, you know? And there's just enough defensive lapses, and you're letting Penn State hang around and hang around and hang around. You know, they're going to have to play. Whoever beats Michigan State's going to have to play really well to do it. There are more talented teams out there. There's better teams, but you're going to have to bring it for 60 minutes to beat those guys.
Walker gives them that elite burst of talent that I think can make the Ohio State game very interesting. I don't know. I don't know if they can beat them. I didn't know if they could beat Michigan, and I'm still not sure how they did, but they did. And I don't know how they beat Nebraska. I think they didn't have like a first down in the third and fourth quarters.
They
did.
They were. Yeah.
Right? I don't know, but they do. And when you have one of these teams – that 100% believes, and you have a very good coach. Like that, they were well coached yesterday. They made terrific adjustments. They found ways to get things done, and that ball gets rolling. I don't know, and I don't think this is the greatest Ohio State team. Do I think if we're picking the Ohio State Michigan State game right now, taking Ohio State, but I'm not gonna put anything past this Spartan team. Particularly after what I watched yesterday, they should have lost that game. They probably should have lost by 3 touchdowns. They won by 4. I don't know. Are they going to go 7-0 on video replay reviews again? Probably not. I mean, just even if they're all right, one of them's going to be wrong against you.
Right, right.
And I mean, that's the key one. The one
that was so close with the leg, the ankle, the shin, whatever.
That was a 4-point play. I was surprised.
That was an overturn that really didn't look like there was a lot to overturn. And that was a 4-point play. It's a 4-point game. So, you know.
Was it such a good game, Dan, that Pat couldn't even bemoan his terrible pick?
Dan's picks were as bad as mine. Wait a minute.
It's the only game I won.
Yeah, exactly. No, I do. Real time, was Pat so wrapped up in the game, he was not concerned with his pick.
Yeah, he was not. I apologize to all listeners.
Because we know Pat focuses on his picks.
The race for the case went terribly awry last week.
Oh, my God.
I told you. I hated my picks.
Yeah,
I warned you, and I was right.
Either.
At that very moment, I should have switched them all. I would have gone 5-1. Instead, I went 1-5. Pat went 1-5. Sully went 1-5. Even Golden Boy Pete Nostradamus went 3-3.
It was a bad week. We apologize to the gamblers.
And let me just tell you something, Lane Kiffin. Kick the damn ball, buddy. Kick the ball. You cannot tell me that Lane Kiffin understands advanced mathematics.
He does not.
Come on, dude. No, what are you doing? It's 4th and 6. Your offense sucks. You got no receivers and you're going for it? Kick the ball.
I pondered. So I was watching that game on my laptop at the Horseshoe and watching the proceedings. And Ryan Day has that same offensive first DNA and gambled on a 4th and 2, called the right play. Chris Olave was wide open. So wide open that when the Penn State defender was out of position, leapt for the ball from the press box, I thought he must have tipped it. Because there's no way that like that ball could not have been completed. Like in it was all of a sudden then he left them vulnerable to lose the game, which happened in the Indiana game last year today. Obviously, he overgambled in that Oregon game as well. And I do wonder if God, like, strike me down for saying this, we need some more D'Antonio in our lives in football. Like, we've gone over-analyticed. And I, like, love gambling. I love fake punts. I love fake field goals. I like onside kick all day. But it just does seem
Did
like.
Did you see the analytics guy roll his eyes, too, behind Kiffin on the broadcast? Like, when he went for it on 4th down, like, you could see the coach behind him, and he just, like, rolled his eyes when they were going for it. It was so funny.
That's pretty funny. I did not see that. But I do feel like that there – I was in a coach's office a couple weeks ago, and he was kind of chuckling at the analytics because he's just like, they don't account for, like, momentum and feel the feeling of charging back on the field coming through. And I'm not saying that like guys should stop going on 4th down and stop being aggressive or anything like that. But I do think like there has to be some like game management, like what decision helps us win the game, not what does the book say. So I just that delicate balance I feel like has been gone this year. And it's not just Lane or Day, but it's you see it more and more and more now. And you've seen it cost as many games as it helped them win. I there's no way to quantify it because then we'd be going back to analytics. But punt a little bit, kick some field goals. Like it's been an interesting trend to see accumulate.
And if you didn't see it, we're talking about Auburn beating Ole Miss 31-20 among other plays, and Lane Kiffin just kept going for it on 4th down. I mean, 4th and 6 is not 4th and 2 with Chris Olave. They didn't have Chris Olave at Ole Miss. My thing with analytics in football, I've said this all along. Yes, they should go for it more often. But this definitive belief that your math is right, what is the analytic of? Right. Is this like is the analytic of can Matt Corral get the ball to a receiver, a third string wide receiver, and on fourth and six, you have this percent? Or is it all plays? Because I always say, like, they used to do in the NFL, and I'd be like, well, yeah, go for it on fourth and two if you have Tom Brady and Rob Gronkowski. Yes, that's a very – that percentage play is – you can't just do what number? There's so many variables. Are you dealing with a second string quarterback? Do you have momentum? What's the emotion of a game? Sometimes you just need points. Hey, we're still in this. We're one score. When Michigan State was down 16, to go back to the other game, Tucker said, he's running around the thing. We're down two scores. We're still in this. We're still in this. Two touchdowns, two-point conversions. So that's very hard. But a bunch of 20-year-olds are like, yeah, we're still in this. We're still in this. And so sometimes emotion, and you see it with State, they were always in that game, or Ole Miss just kept walking off the field like defeated. And I don't care about your math problem. There's too many variables for me to believe you have accurate analytics to where you're making, you know, real close decisions on things, because personnel matters on your side and their side.
100%. It happened in the first half of Ohio State, Penn State. James Franklin did it. They're right at midfield. It was fourth and short, and Ohio State couldn't piss a drop on offense in the first half. They certainly couldn't run the ball. It was the Penn State run defense from 1 week ago to this week is the most baffling thing to me. I can't understand it at all.
Yeah,
but
from
Ohio
357
State,
yards to Illinois,
yes,
to
yes, they made Illinois look like Travion they had Henderson. The Pony Express, and then Travion Henderson couldn't wriggle out of anything in the first half. He was running into a cement wall. They had like 19 yards on whatever carry. So Penn State has momentum. Their defense is stopping them. They could pin them with a punt and it kills some momentum. Instead, they hand them the ball back at midfield. And it's just like one of those things where, like, 5 years ago, nobody would have gone for it on fourth down there at midfield. And I'm not saying that cost Franklin the game or anything anything like that. And I do think it didn't translate or backfire. Ohio State ended up punting. They went three and out and punted. So it didn't matter, I guess, on that. But it was just one of those bizarre things where you're like, okay, this is analytics.
It mattered because you punt it down there, they go three and out and punt it back to you, you're at midfield.
Yeah. Exactly. I believe I'm looking at the drive chart here. I believe that is what happened. Ohio State went three and out. And then Penn State.
I don't trust these analytics. The analytics has gotten to the point where it's like, this is the hard and fast scientific rule. Math says do this. And it's like, dude, all math is whatever data you're putting in. And there's no way you have the accurate. What's the percent on that situation of Ole Miss on the road with this personnel against that personnel and the confidence? It's not a math equation. It's football.
It's not. Absolutely. And that's to see there's two things at work here, I think. One is, you know, football has become so big and important that we're just going to throw staff at everything. And so if we need more staff, by golly, well, let's just get some number guys. And so they'll pay your number guys to come in and you know, crunch all the numbers on everything. And then that gives you plausible deniability. Well, it didn't work well, but that's what the analytics said. Let's just throw that out there. There's your blanket answer. Well, analytics said to do it. And there's your get out of jail free card. Also, fans for the most part now want you to go for it. Okay, so if you've got the fans behind you and the analytics behind you, there's less chance that you're going to be booed off the field when it doesn't work. But at the end of the day, win the game with the best chance for your players to do what they need to do. And sometimes that's punting. Sometimes that's kicking field goals.
Sully, can you name this podcast Three Men Yell at Cloud, Death to Analytics?
Yes. The Death to Analytics pod.
Not death, but by God, put it in the corner at least.
Well, so I think Ole Miss analytics its way right out of the SEC West race, out of the top 10. Auburn analytics did way right into, hey, now we're still here. Only got one loss in league.
No more Iron Bowl. Auburn, baby.
They can't move.
Stuff
right?
Has happened in the Iron Bowl in Auburn before.
Yeah. Of a sudden, Auburn's still there. And Bo Nix played real well yesterday. And look at Bo.
Pat, have you booked the Columbus Marriott yet? Your favorite Columbus, Georgia Marriott?
I need to get on that.
That is the Pat Forty Hotel. He is the Chamber of Commerce chair for Columbus, Georgia, in that little dive bar with a bunch of beers on tap. So
that's right.
So
Pat comes to Michigan this weekend, and I go, where are you staying? He goes, Jackson, Michigan. I didn't even know anyone ever went to Jackson. I thought it was like a hollowed out town. Like, no, they have hotels there?
It is.
I thought we were friends. Lots of hotels near my house.
Nobody said, hey, you want to do anything Friday night? No. I didn't hear anything from anybody.
You picked this random place? Like, not the airport, not Lansing, not Jackson, not Ann Arbor.
Outsmarted myself. Closer to East Lansing. I figure noon game. Traffic's going to be bad going in. I'll get as close as I can, according to the little Marriott hotel finder.
Well, fine. I didn't miss you. So,
is this the revenge for the fishing trip?
I might be.
Yeah, right. No,
I would have hung out with him, but no, I wasn't driving to damn Jackson.
Well, I would have been happy to stay in Royal or Oak or Oak Royal or wherever, you know. But
Jackson sounds like a made up town from a Bruce Springsteen song where the factory got shut down.
Chevys. That's where they get the spirit of East Lansing. They're just trying to ruin cars so they have to make more. Burn that Chevy. We'll get one more off the line over there at Lansing Assembly. All right. Other big game Saturday. Number one, Georgia just houses Florida. Debacle at the end of the second quarter. Stetson Bennett. Our number one, you know, they always are like, well, the quarterback of the number one team should be a Heisman candidate. Anyone want to do the Stetson Bennett campaign? 10-19, 161, TD and two picks. Doesn't matter. UF actually outgains Georgia by a yard. Doesn't matter. Georgia's defense is so good. So much talent. The discussion after the game is why can't Dan Mullen recruit? Is that fair or is it just unfair to expect anyone better than Georgia? I mean, is it fair to say Florida's got to have better players? Mullen's point was we beat them last year. Our players were good enough then. What about this year? Pat?
I think this was a bit of an overreaction, frankly. Because, I mean, look, I think Georgia is a touchdown better than anyone else in America right now. I would take them and give 7 to Ohio State. I would take them and give 7 to Alabama. I would take them and give 7 to Michigan State. I would take them and give 7 to Cincinnati. So I think they're that good. So losing this game, that's why I'm a little bit surprised that everybody's like, oh, my God, look at Florida. Look at the shape Florida's in. This is probably cumulative effect more from other losses, you know, from losing to LSU and losing to Kentucky. But I didn't see this as the critical mass game where it's time to give up on Dan Mullen because everybody's going to lose to Georgia. Now, this was a little worse maybe than some people thought it was going to be, including the three of us, because we were all stupid enough to take the 14 points. Is there some truth to it? Yeah. I mean, Kirby Smart's recruited as well as anybody in the country, including Nick Saban, in the last 3 or 4 years. You know, I mean, their recruiting class has been number one, number one, number one, I believe, right? The 3 of the last 4 years?
Killing it. Yeah. A bunch of them. I'll check, but, I mean, they got 5 5 stars committed for next year.
Yeah.
Rivals, so, 5 stars. Yeah.
I mean, Kirby's point is legitimate and germane here that – you know, the teams with the best talent should win, and he didn't say it, but they have the best talent right now. So, you know, so does Florida need to recruit better to compete with that? Yeah, I think so. And, you know, but yeah, we're forgetting the fact that they not just beat them, they destroyed them last year. They won the SEC East. They nearly beat Alabama in the SEC Championship game. Hell, they nearly beat Alabama in September. People have been throwing out there, you know, Mullen's lost, I don't know, 7 of his last 9 to FBS competition or Power 5 competition. Well, 2 of those were Alabama. 1 of those is Georgia. Everybody else is going to lose those games, true. There may have been some other bad losses in there, but I think this is a little bit of an overreaction right now.
I think recruiting-wise, Florida should have better players. And I'm not saying they're recruiting terribly. But as I said last week, neither Florida State nor Miami is rolling right now. Somebody needs to dominate that state in recruiting. Yeah. And so if there's those 3, and there's too many great players going to Alabama, going to Clemson, going to Georgia, going to Oklahoma, leaving the state, going to Ohio State. That is my only thing. They should be better. I'm not saying they're bad and they have bad players. And I agree with Dan Mullen on, I mean, geez, we gave Alabama the best game last year, and you know, Georgia had a walk-on quarterback. Like, where's the five-star there at the most important position?
Well, pretty good point.
I do think they should be better because there is not appreciable competition the last 5 years from Miami a little bit and definitely not from Florida State. And so with that, well, where the hell are all these great players going? Well, you need to get a little bit more outsized portion of great Florida talent, but I don't know.
Has anyone ever seen Sully and Stetson Bennett in the same room? Just throwing that out there.
Good point.
I think this. I think the reverberation from this loss for Florida is how deep does Dan Mullen look at staff overhaul this offseason? I think the assumption is Todd Grantham is going to get fired, which will be greeted with a chorus of hallelujahs, from there. But if you need to overhaul your staff to better recruit, that gets tricky. Do you still have Tim Brewster, a great longtime old school recruiter, around? Do you need to get younger? Do you need to really shake things up? There really are only like two young bucks on this staff. The corners coach, Jules Monitor, and then Christian Robinson, the linebacker coach, who's really well regarded. I think he actually played at Georgia, if I'm right. How much does Mullen have to overcorrect here to do that? Florida has struggled getting the best players from Florida. It's pretty simple. Alabama, when they've really started to build this thing, Crystal Ball started it as an assistant. They really started to go into Miami and get some of the best players. Like, Florida has to go attack some of those strongholds and make them Gator strongholds again. Now, look, this is all cyclical, right? Georgia has done what, they love to, it's great, as you said, stacked classes. They've stacked classes. One great class on top of the next great class on top of the next great class. The problem with a year like this for Georgia is that I went through this with Jim Nagy and then with two national scouts who've gone through Georgia this year. We came up with a number, 17 Georgia players could get drafted. So Georgia could have more players drafted by far than any other team in the history of college football. So all of a sudden, when you lose some of these, big, burly D linemen. I mean, the thing about that makes Georgia great is they just put defensive linemen in waves. You just don't do that. Like, that just doesn't happen. Where the best indicator of how talented Georgia is that Jalen Carter, big number 88, is technically a reserve. He has 20 quarterback hurries on the season. So he has 6.5 TFLs, 3 sacks, 20 quarterback hurries. Now, again, I don't know if that's a quantifiable stat, if the NCAA tracks it. I'm sure ESPN Stats and Info and some of these places could do that. Like, that is preposterous for a backup, quote-unquote backup defensive lineman, to have hurried the quarterback 20 different times. They have 5 different players with double-digit quarterback hurries. I mean, they're an embarrassment of riches. But those riches are going to go, and then we're going to see now if Kirby Smart can do what Nick Saban's done, is that balance this. Does Munkin get a job, who's the talented OC who's done a nice job with what he's had this year? Dan Lanning seems like he's going to be the belle of the ball in this carousel. He's about 35 years old, young, really sharp defensive coordinator. You've got to think he's going to be in the top 5 for the Broyles, like no-brainer, right? You can't be the architect of this defense, and he is the play caller. It is his defense. He's really turned and changed. I wrote about it a couple of weeks ago to put his own stamp on that, like, smart Saban system. He's evolved it and grown it to a better mousetrap. So it will be curious going forward. And I say all that to say, what's to say that Georgia remains this far ahead of Florida next year when Florida was ahead of them last year? You can stack classes all you want, but when you start losing these swaths of NFL guys, it's just hard to, add water and replace them. So I will be curious. I do think Mullen changes things. I do not think in any universe Dan Mullen is on the hot seat. I've chuckled at every reference I've seen to that on Twitter because I just don't think. Scott Strickland, remember, Dan Mullen had some lean-ish years at Mississippi State, and Scott Strickland didn't flinch. I think he knows exactly what he has in him. And I just have not gotten any sense from anybody at Florida. But this has certainly been humbling for Dan Mullen, and it will be interesting to see how he changes and evolves and grows from this.
Got to say one thing here. You said that the problem George is going to have, that's the problem every coach wants, though, is have 17 guys drafted and then go out recruiting and say, guess what? Watch the draft. Come to here, you're going to get drafted.
So that's how you got five-stars committed. Yeah. Georgia is absolutely stacked. All right, let's do this. First playoff rankings coming out Tuesday night. And we will, we're going to tape late. We're going to tape late so we can get in the first rankings. We'll wait for this dog and pony show. So don't expect us, usual, you know, dinner time on the East Coast, release on Tuesday. We'll be late because we're going to wait for the playoff committee show or whatever the hell they're calling it. Let's do this. I'll name a school. You guys, let's all figure out where they're going to be ranked and where should they be ranked. Okay. Start with an easy one. Georgia Bulldogs. 1-1.
1-1. No,
1-1.
Yeah. No ifs, ands, or buts. That's going to be a very easy call.
Okay. We're Oklahoma. 9-0. Pat, I think they'll be in the top four.
8.
I wish that's the where they could should see be. Pat's face.
Yeah. Pat's face.
They should be.
Pat took a bite of a lemon in between that, apparently, just as I was asking that question. They should be 8.
Washed it down with sour milk and then a Bush Light.
That they should be 8. They're probably going to be 4th or something like that. Yeah, am I just over the irrational Oklahoma love fest that's based on very, very, very little other than they've won all their games. I'll give them credit for that. You know, but so is Wake Forest. And I'm not sure Wake Forest should get any less love than Oklahoma at this point.
You believe that? Think they'll be top four?
I don't think Oklahoma will be top four. I do not have like so I'm just going to start spitting arbitrary numbers and try to fit them around. But I think Oklahoma should be 6-8.
I mean, look at this schedule. Okay. 40-35 against Tulane at home. They crush Western Carolina. Who cares? 23-16 Nebraska at home. 16-13 to West Virginia at home. 37-31 at Kansas State. Might be their best win. Texas 55-48 at the Cotton Bowl. TCU, they beat 52-31. 35-23 at Kansas. They were losing at the half, or was it tied? Or it was terrible.
Yeah, they were down 10-0 at halftime to the worst team in the Power 5.
They beat Texas Tech, which fired its coach and gave up on its kids and is a shameful administration. 52-21 at home. Obviously, you know, they got at Baylor, they got Iowa State, they're at Oklahoma State. There's a Big 12. They're going to play one of those three teams again. They got a lot of work to do, but I'm with you. There's people voting them number 2 in the 8. Like, other than it says Oklahoma on their jersey, what the hell have they done? This looks like Notre Dame without the loss. And nobody sits there and says, hey, you know, you go, great job this year. You guys are winning. You're finding a way to win games, but you ain't that good. Maybe you should prove it, but anticipate they'll be in there, but they shouldn't.
Blue blood helium, which has always been a thing. And secondly, you know, the obstinance of voters that had them high to begin with and refused to ever move them down. Like when they were life and death to beat Tulane the first week at home after Tulane had been displaced by a hurricane and this game was supposed to be in New Orleans but ended up in Norman, and they win that game by 5 points right there. Like, holy crap, move them down 5 spots. You know, and then keep them down there when they're skeeching by all this bad competition. But no, by golly, if we had them in the top 5 before the season, we got to keep them in the top 5 because they haven't lost. That's that stupid.
All right. Well, this is what the committee is not supposed to do. They're supposed to look at all the things and have a reasonable discussion and pay attention. And they don't have, right? They have no preseason poll and they rip it up every week and they waste their time down there. Do you have any faith in them doing it right?
So, Pat, would you put Wake Forest ahead of Oklahoma?
Maybe. I don't know. I haven't really scrubbed Wake Forest's resume vis-a-vis theirs, like side by side.
I can give you their schedule. Right, let me give you the wins, okay? Wake Forest is 8-0. I had to beat Old Dominion, Norfolk State. Who cares? They beat Florida State 35-14. They went at Virginia by 20. They went a close one against Louisville at home. They win an overtime at Syracuse. They win a wild shootout with Army at Army 70, and then they just truck Duke. Not a lot of meat on that bone. 8-0. I wouldn't put them in there.
No, I think it's a comparable resume to Oklahoma's. They've had a couple more authoritative wins, maybe. You know, I mean, win by 20 on the road in a league game is good. But I would say like. One of them should be 8, the other should be 9.
The problem they have at Carolina, NC State, at Clemson, at BC, who knows if they can make it through that. But if they do, and then the ACC championship game, they may not play a ranked team. Who knows? you know, and so they could really be, you could easily have a 13-1 team or 13-0 team from the ACC without a whole lot to come up with.
Think about that. That's wild. A team in the Atlantic Coast Conference could go undefeated and not beat a ranked team.
Yeah.
That's
and
pretty,
even go
that's
13-0. I mean, yeah, Pittsburgh spitting the bit, you know, is taking the luster off of the their campaign.
Oh,
there,
their non-conference is the two easy games. And then the Carolina game is a non-conference game.
Yeah.
They play North Carolina, but it's not a conference game. So they end up with an extra ACC game, but that's not helping them. Where if they had just played, you know, I don't know what, South Carolina, I mean, South Carolina's like it, but you know what I mean. They played somebody else, you might have, hey, this is a decent non-conference win. Carolina's their non-conference win if they can beat Carolina, who just lost to Notre Dame.
Yeah, they've decided as a team to stop tackling at North Carolina. That was my takeaway from the Notre Dame game. So that's probably going to help.
That was not a great defensive effort by the Tar Heels. All right, where do you put 8-0 Michigan State?
I would put them number two. I had them number three myself going into this last week, and then you beat Michigan. I would move them up because I had Michigan number two, so I'd move them up. I'd have Cincinnati three. I think Michigan State and Cincinnati are close to each other, 2-3. You know, I don't know whether those two will be there or not with the committee. I have my doubts. We can discuss in a minute the dragging of Cincinnati, but I think Michigan State has shown a lot. Okay, I mean, there was some questioning of their resume, but they were the first team to go 4-0 on the road. First team to get four road wins, and they were pretty authoritative wins. You know, you beat Northwestern by 17, you beat Miami by 21, beat Rutgers by 18. The Indiana game was close, but you know, they've gone away from home and done some stuff, and then they had the big signature win in a hell of a game that I think if everybody watched it, you were impressed by both teams.
Yeah, I would put Michigan State three. I think that's the right place for them. They have certainly earned that in every way possible. Yeah, it would be interesting if they end up with one loss, which is to Ohio State, what their one loss candidacy is without a league title. Once you start, you know, Ralph Russo plays that great game, which one do you leave out? One loss Michigan State could end up as a pretty intriguing one loss. Yeah, all credit to Mel Tucker, man. That is, he is, send the Eddie Robinson Award. Send it to East Lansing today. It's won by Halloween.
The job he has done is, I mean, it's almost off the charts. I mean, falling apart under D'Antonio at the end. Takes over late, if you remember.
And they just didn't have any talent.
I mean, there's some of these guys are D'Antonio recruited, but yeah, there was not great talent. He gets the job late because Mark does not retire when he should have in the open. So they have to overpay, get him in here. They get him in, and he gets to Michigan State. He does not have great recruiting ties in the state. The first 90 days of any coach in the country is going to be, especially in the spring, you know, you got spring practice to meet your team, and then you're going to run around the state, meeting high school coaches, meeting workout guys, running around the Midwest. We go into lockdown. We're going to COVID, and he doesn't get to do any of that. Doesn't know his team. They win two games last year, albeit one of them's against Michigan, and then hits the transfer portal, meshes this team together. Nobody expects anything out of him, and boom. I mean, it's just a tremendous coach of the year material, and that's why LSU and USC and, man, the NFL is looking. I can tell you right now, the NFL has noticed East Lansing, because he did a lot of years in the NFL, and Mel Tucker is rolling. So it may be more bitters on that than just LSU and USC, and obviously Michigan State trying to keep. So what he does, I don't know. My guess is he's probably not long for East Lansing, but certainly you never know. It was a special day yesterday for him.
We may have talked about this a couple months ago. One thing I just want to give him the most credit for is D'Antonio was the single worst coach in college football to NFL scouts. They were limited when they could go. They were limited how much they could go. He treated them, every one of them, like they were bank robbers coming to there. It would be like the business school not letting Apple come recruit their students. It's the single dumbest thing college football coaches can do. And Mark D'Antonio is the worst. So Mel Tucker, under Nick Saban, who is the single best at it, learned, completely changed it. And now the worst visit is Michigan, which has always been a terrible visit, but it wasn't as terrible as Michigan State. So Jim Harbaugh, if you're going to change anything, do not treat the scouts like they're on fire. Like, it's just, I can't fathom how you would sit around in a meeting and go, let's be really mean to the guys who could make our players millionaires. Because you know what you do? Those fringe guys, those sixth, seventh round picks, they just, guys aren't going to be invested. Guys aren't going to be invested. Like, when we write stories, if people call us back and are, like, loquacious, we're going to, like, probably write a better story, right? You're going to get better time. You're going to have better access. You're going to have better information. And the fact that Michigan is still a Neanderthal about that is just, that's, administratively, Ward Manuel should be ashamed and Jim Harbaugh should be ashamed. I have more scouts complain to me about going to Michigan, and they're hurting their players, and it's going to trickle down to recruiting. And don't you think Mel Tucker doesn't sit there and say, look at these scouts. We're feeding them dinner. We're letting them in. We're wide open.
No, that is one of the most bizarre things in college football and basketball that some of these coaches do. I mean, you recruit a guy to your school and you sit there and say, I want what's best for you. You should do everything you can to get them to the professional ranks. Like, why would you screw some kid over? And yeah, and the idea that they're going to leave a year early, that's just the ball game. You know, that's just there used to be that whole.
Michigan doesn't talk about their draft eligible juniors. They won't even talk to scouts about them because Jim Harbaugh still thinks it's like 1984 and everybody should stick around for a while. Like
the revolution in basketball that went down, because there's all those years of nobody, my kid would never, don't even come and talk to me. And then a bunch of coaches, and most notably, and this is the one who got the turnstile going best, was Calipari, was like, I start talking to him about going pro when I'm talking to them as juniors in high school. Like, this is where you come in, we're going to get you out of here. And I remember he used to celebrate. And he said once, like, five guys got drafted in the first round. It's the greatest night in the history of Kentucky basketball, and all the fans got mad. But it's like, lost all your players. Guess what? Five more will show up. And so I'll say you got to do that. But, yeah, it's how you treat your scouts. So there you go. It's a random one. But, yeah, Mel Tucker. NFL scout coach of the year.
I just give Mel Tucker credit. Like, just give Mel Tucker credit. Like, these guys are just trying to do their job. They're not, like, going to go report to who you're playing that week that you're faking a punt. And I do think it shows how, like, Jim Harbaugh is so weird and so aloof that nobody could even talk sense to him. I guess his post-game press conference was like an abject disaster after the Michigan State game, which shouldn't be a surprise because every time he loses, Jim Harbaugh just, like, mumbles a few sentences and doesn't give anything. Well, the players were loquacious, thoughtful, like introspective. It's just he's a weird man.
I don't know. I didn't think it was that bad. I was there. I listened to it. I didn't think any of them were very good. I didn't think that Harbaugh was especially terrible or the players were especially loquacious.
Yeah, I don't know. The players were more loquacious, but introspective. But I didn't think he was that bad. I mean, he wasn't answering a ton of questions, but no. I mean, I don't know what you're expecting out of that. I didn't think he was that bad.
Yeah. I just remember him a few times after they lost, especially at Ohio State. That's probably usually when I see them the most, where he was just like, I don't know. I guess he did that in the NFL too, so we shouldn't be surprised.
He answers some questions in odd manners. There's no question. But I did not think he was too bad.
He answers every question like he's surprised someone's asking him a question.
He just basically, they would ask him like, hey, Jim, how disappointing was it that the guy dropped the ball? And he would just say, well, the guy dropped the ball. That he doesn't really say. But I did not think he was bad after that. I was standing there. I didn't think he was bad at all. His press conference was adequate. Coached it. Had a crushing time. And, I mean, it's tough for – I mean, didn't want to switch. We'll get back to who's getting in the playoff. But, I mean, it's tough for Jim Harbaugh.
I totally hijacked that.
You know, he needs to beat his rivals. And he isn't. So, all right, let's get back to it. The other undefeated team, Cincinnati, in the top four, and should they be? Pat?
Yes and yes. Boy, I am fascinated to see what the committee does. And where they start with them will matter. That, you know, the first one, where do they, what's their view of them up to this point at 8-0? Have they done enough to be in the top four to begin with, which is terra incognita for group of five schools? I think they absolutely should be, but I've seen people already start to like throw tomatoes at Cincinnati. I love Heather Dinich. She used to work with her at ESPN. She's a friend, but she tweeted something citing ESPN stats and info. So this is really who my beef is with, saying that if Cincinnati makes the playoff field undefeated, they would be the weakest team to ever make the playoff field, and there would be 9 1-loss teams that made it that would be better than them.
The stat is like, math is whatever data you put in. It has
exactly.
They could be the greatest team in the history of football, and they'd be the worst because of where they play. ESPN's FPI or whatever. Remember, it was saying like USC still had a 23%. I mean, that thing sucks. Like, that thing sucks. Of all the computer formulas out there, that one sucks. But of course,
I agree. I would like an explanation of what the hell it actually is.
They're automatically going to have that. I don't know. Are they the top four team? I probably wouldn't put them in. I don't know. I'll say this, though. Their win at Notre Dame, which is a top 10 team, is, other than Oregon at Ohio State, might be the best win of the year. Yeah. It's on the road against a top 10 team. How many of those are out there? So there's that. All right, let's get to the other ones. Let's get to Ohio State and Oregon, because this is already turning into Ohio State deserves in. And wait, who are the Ducks? Ohio State, are they going to be in the top four? And should they be?
They should not be in the top four to start. But I do think one of the defining debates of this next couple weeks is going to be one loss Ohio State versus one loss Oregon. And it would be very difficult for the committee with a straight face to put in Ohio State over Oregon, but I wouldn't discount that happening.
If only there was a way to tell which team was better.
Yeah. And don't forget, Kayvon Thibodeau and Justin Flo did not play.
And it was in the horseshoe.
And they had a couple other
starters. And it was in the horseshoe. And it wasn't close.
No. It was a 7-point game that Oregon never trailed and pretty well had in hand for a lot of the game. They had to withstand the late. Things got a little bit tight late, but that was a game that Oregon was the better team, period.
So let me play the foil here. Ohio State has demoted its defensive coordinator, improved pretty significantly on that side of the ball, and they've made Travion Henderson their featured running back, and he is going to be a defining running back of the next 10 years in college football. I think he's tremendously talented and showed it yesterday with a couple of big bursts after struggling in the first half. So, like, it's a Ohio State has grown and evolved and are different and have performed fairly well, and I mean remarkably well in 3 or 4 games and decent in a couple others since that game. So that is what you're going to have. Like, you're going to have that moment in time, and then what Ohio State's become since that moment in time that's going to define this debate, because it is going to be a loud and raucous debate, because really Oregon doesn't have much of a chance to give any kind of signature win from here on out. Oregon closes the season with a bad Washington team in Seattle, a somewhat resurgent Washington State team in Eugene, but nobody's gonna give you a feather for beating the Cougars with an interim coach. Now they have Utah and Salt Lake City. That is certainly a game that will have some heft. Utah is playing very well right now. They may again see Utah in the Pac-12 title game. So beating Utah twice could be very difficult. And then they have Oregon State, which is a good salty Oregon State team, and give Jonathan Smith a lot of credit for what he's been able to build there. But so right now they have no top 25 games remaining. And the only chance they have for a top 25 game remaining, quite frankly, is if Utah beats them, then gets ranked in the top 25, and then they play them in the Pac-12 title game. So whereas Ohio State is going to have to go to Michigan, who should still be ranked in the top 25, and they're going to have a top 5 Michigan State team come beat them at home. So the head-to-head argument is there, and it is what it is, but there is going to – Ohio State could build a pretty compelling argument
on the
other side.
Ohio State will win the argument, and they'll get in over Oregon, even though they played. This is why you need a bigger playoff.
Yeah,
that's where
teams do get better. I'm not even disputing the Buckeyes thing. Teams improve across the year, and that's good. And you do what you also want to reward as a sport, non-conference scheduling. And so, like, what was the point for Oregon? Like, you go win that game.
Right. You go.
The whole thing, you can't defy logic to an illogical system. And that's what they try to do on this committee. And that's why this playoff just is terribly designed. It was designed by people who didn't want to design a playoff. They didn't study it and do what they did on the other thing. And they came up with this crap. And so you sit there and go, they played each other and one team was on the road and they didn't have all their best players and they won handily. Yeah, that doesn't count.
Yeah. I mean, that's the point. And Pete, you absolutely nailed the tension of this thing. It's going to be Ohio State got better, but Oregon was better that day. And to me, I think you have to default to what happened on the field between the two. But I know that Ohio State, bigger brand name, and they will have gone through a high-profile end-of-the-season schedule. And then the default is just, well, we were young, and we had the wrong guy being our coordinator. But that's also on you to have the wrong guy being your coordinator. You can't really just say, well, that doesn't really count, you know? I mean, so, but that is absolutely the argument, provided both these teams keep winning and going forward.
The media cry will probably be behind the Buckeyes. So, all right. A
few more TV sets in the state of Ohio than there are in the state of
Oregon. That's supposed to matter when you're in there in that committee.
Oregon has better wineries. Ohio State has more TV sets.
Baylor, Oklahoma State, 7-1. We got, you know, they got, basically, you're going to have to beat Oklahoma. We'll see if anyone comes out of the Big 12. But that is where we're at. All right. We like to hand out the Heisman every week because we don't like to wait. So our small sample Heisman.
Hello, record book.
Hello, small sample Heisman.
How about that?
All right, I'll go first. My small sample Heisman. Hey, I loved watching Kenneth Walker in person in Spartan Stadium. He was dazzling. In terms of the large sample Heisman, he's probably at the top of my list right now. But for small sample for today, I've got to go back to my guy Tyler Allgeier at BYU, who absolutely trampled Virginia. Virginia was so tired of tackling him in the second half, they just stopped trying. 29 carries, 266 yards, 9 yards a pop, 5 touchdowns. This guy's having an unbelievable season. He's played linebacker. He's played running back. But he's had 2 200-yard rushing games this year, plus 191 against Washington State. He is the finisher of games. He closes games for them. Tough, hard runner. Goes through people, not around them. And he just so happens to have the best defensive play of anybody this season as well, because he was the guy that had the flying come from behind tomahawk punch out of the fumble return against Arizona State back in September, if you remember. So Tyler Allgeier is my small sample Heisman winner, and he may well end up on my big sample ballot eventually when this season is over.
I'm going to take the unusual step of giving my small sample Heisman this week to an obscure assistant coach. It goes to Terry Malone, who is the running back coach and offensive coordinator at Bowling Green. Scott Leffler, the Bowling Green head coach, got thrown out of the game against Buffalo on Saturday for 2 unsportsmanlike conduct penalties. I've seen multiple people report he's the first head coach in FBS history since they changed the rules about ejection in 2016 to get thrown out of the game, which is just amazing if you really think about it. Like, when it happened, I was like, I texted it to the group. I was like, I've never seen this happen before. It has actually never happened before. We've all seen, like, Bob Huggins get 2 technicals and get chucked or whatever it is. That happens in basketball a couple times a season. And even then, it's rare, very rare if somebody gets chucked in an NCAA tournament game per se. But a college football head coach had not been tossed until Leffler. And so what does Bowling Green promptly do? Scott Leffler is the play caller. Terry Malone takes over the play call, and they probably score 4 touchdowns in the fourth quarter. And this is from ESPN.com story. In 18 minutes after Leffler's ejection, Bowling Green scored more points than in any full game over the last 2 seasons.
There you go. I need a raise, coach.
That's amazing. They also beat Buffalo by the final score of 56-44. So somewhere Terry Malone right now is an old offensive coordinator at Michigan. Dan, I'm sure you ran across him up there. He's an old hand. He's been around for a while. Is smiling, and we will be sending a small sample Heisman to Bowling Green.
All right, I'm giving it to Houston cornerback and returner Marcus Jones. You want clutch? SMU ties the game with UH at 37 with 30 seconds left. And there ain't a whole lot Houston's going to be able to do. They could try to mount some drive, but whatever, to try to get in field goal range and win this game, or this thing's going to overtime. SMU, which is 7-0 at the time, ranked 19th, and had a chance to set up an incredible game against Cincinnati that Cincinnati really could have used, makes the ill-fated decision to kick to my guy, Marcus. For the 9th time in his career, he catches the ball and goes all the way to the house, touchdown. 9th kick return career. Terrible decision. Should have squib kicked it. Should have put it out of bounds at the five and take your penalty. Should have done anything you possibly can and give it to the one guy who can beat you. He went out and beat you, and now SMU has a loss. Epic, epic play. And so I'm giving my small sample Heisman, mainly played decent defense, I'm sure, but mainly on the strength of the one great kick return. Good job, Marcus Jones.
I mean, that is a terrible decision by Sonny Dykes. My gosh.
I think Sonny Dykes just wanted to send a message that he didn't want to go to Lubbock to take the Texas Tech job. He said, you know what? I'm going to make coaching malfeasance so strong that they wanted to hire Jeff Traylor instead. That was a remarkably dumb decision.
There's a little bit. I mean, they weren't stopping him. And if you give him at the 35, you get a kid, you know, like in 30 seconds left, or you give it to
bounce that thing, bounce the kick, man.
Can't give it to the home run hitter. Yep. I mean, it'd be one thing if just anybody did it. But this is your ninth career kick return for a touchdown? What is the record? I don't know.
That's got to be near the record if it's not.
Imagine how that SMU special teams coach feels today breaking down his film.
Oh.
All right. We have said some mean things on the podcast. Some deserve, some not. Let's say something nice. Pat Forty, can you say something nice?
I can, and I will. Even legitimately this time, I'm going to say something nice about Notre Dame, which keeps finding ways to win. And I made something of a deal before the season started about all of the games where they were playing, where their opponent was coming off an open date and had that bye week advantage over Notre Dame. North Carolina was the fifth one of those on Saturday. Guess who won? Notre Dame. USC was the fourth one of those. Who won? Notre Dame. Virginia Tech was the third one. Who won? Notre Dame. Wisconsin was the first. Who won? Notre Dame. The one they lost was Cincinnati, which is a damn good team. So I thought that would lead to multiple losses potentially for the Irish. And yes, granted, Wisconsin, Virginia Tech, I mean, all those teams have been a bit disappointing, but still, Notre Dame has won the games. And this is not a great Notre Dame team, but Brian Kelly is doing a hell of a job coaching them. And for them to be sitting here with one loss going into November, I am impressed by the Irish.
I'm going to say something nice about Washington State. And somebody might have said something nice about them last week, but I'm going to double down on today because they absolutely thumped Arizona State in Tempe. I believe Arizona State was about a 16-point favorite in this game. And Washington State absolutely pounced on them. They led 34-7 in the fourth quarter. All right. And it's telling that Arizona State had everything to play for in terms of the Pac-12 South, and Washington State with their coach run. Now, look, they're still in pretty good shape. They've won four Pac-12 games in a row. I'm not wishing that away, but they had a lot less to play for than Arizona State. Arizona State had a home game, your two touchdown favorite, and they just laid a dinosaur egg. And you have to wonder if the administration, Michael Crow, the president of Arizona State, and others are going to start getting into, you know, maybe we should just like take away this bull bid with this NCAA investigation coming and like get things going, because they've maneuvered to save the season there. The season is no longer saved. Give all the credit in the world for Washington State for kicking their tail up and down the season. You got to remember, they have three analysts promoted to coaches, and then two dudes they picked up off the street are coaching on offense right now. All right. And they absolutely ran Arizona State ragged. So all props to Jake Diggert and the Cougs.
That was actually skillful, Pete. That cues to the tradition and the ethos of the pod where you said something nice, but also ripped the hell out of another team. So that was good.
We try. I've learned from the best, Pat.
All right. I'm going to say something nice. I was going to say something nice about Mississippi State, which is now 5-3 after defeating Kentucky pretty handily. And they have been knocked out. Like, they were teetering to bad season like 3-4 times. They just keep coming back. Roland Georgia also wins the East, SEC East on that. But I am going to say something nice to a group of people: Chelsea Reppin, Claire Duffy, Rebecca Koppelman, and Cedar Rapids, Iowa Mayor Brad Hart. These four got together over last week and held the 2021 Best Tasting Water in Iowa contest. This is the judges. I believe these four are of impeccable credentials and honesty. And they sat around and drank water all day from various places in Iowa that brought their water. I believe it was Mayor Hart who wondered, how do I cleanse my palate in the middle of a water tasting contest, which I thought was pretty good. This is it. This is where we find out. Just is the Iowa Hooray Aim song a partial fraud or a full fraud? A partial fraud, because we know all the people in the video who sang about I'd never leave, how great it is in Ames, and it's so great a place to live. We now know they live in Baltimore, in Georgia, the little married couple, and then in Boston. They all moved. But what about the water? Because that's all we hear about is the water. Well, here it is. Okay?
And the winner
they
is?
They brought in the water. Here it is. Water came from Keokuk. Is that how you say it? Keokuk, Iowa?
Yep.
Okay. I don't know.
That's an excellent pronunciation out of you.
Cedar Falls, Ames, Cedar Rapids, Des Moines, Iowa Lakes, and West Des Moines. This is the creme de la creme of Iowa water departments. The best of the best.
The Super Seven. Yeah,
this is a battle royal. Oh, my God. Iowa WrestleMania. Water. You know, I mean, this is it. Congratulations. Not you, Ames, you liars. Keokuk Municipal Water Works wins for the second year in a row. They were the defending champs. I didn't know this.
2 years in a row. Keokuk is the champion. Keokuk, water.
Iowa. And wow. I just like to say, I had no idea they did this each year. How freaking boring is it in Iowa that they have water drinking contests?
That's the bottom line there. Yes. Every year you're going to get together and have a water tasting. My God.
I love Ames. It's this plucky school. It's they love Bush Light. They got the great basketball and football crowds, passionate fans. Occasionally they get some good teams, but they lie. They lie and pretend they're better than they are. They're uppity on their water. They sit there and say they're the best when Keokuk, little old Keokuk over there in eastern Iowa, population 9,900, no one's singing songs about Keokuk. Hooray, Keokuk. Ames, you are a bunch of liars. You're the lyingest city in Iowa.
There it is. The Wetzel investigation has reached its climax now. We know that the singers were all frauds and the water itself is a fraud. I thought your next investigation was going to be the tuba at Spartan Stadium, but we probably don't have time to get into that.
And note, we didn't even mention that Iowa State lost to West Virginia this week, speaking of frauds, because
right?
This Iowa State season has collapsed spectacularly.
It's terrible. Can't even beat Keokuk in a water fight. Let's get to that tuba, because we're going to forget the tuba. So that's real quick. If you're listening at this point, you'll listen
everybody
for
two. Everybody just hang with us for another couple more minutes.
So, Pat at a game, he's got three different color pens. He's writing every play down, color coordinate, run play, where he's paying great attention to the game. And as you might expect, I am not. Less attention is being paid by me. I become obsessed with the fact that Michigan State made the Michigan band sit in the farthest reaches of Spartan Stadium. Like, it's like seven-story climb up to where they had...
Yeah, the corner of the upper level.
Nobody but a few passing birds flying south for the winter could hear Hail to the Victors. And then to get for the halftime show, they had to walk all the way down. So they had to leave at the start of the second quarter and march all the way down.
Yeah, I missed the whole quarter. This little whole quarter.
So they got to go up and down carrying tubas. Seven-eighths floors. Easy. So as they...
This is actually what Wetzel was talking about and looking at during the game,
leave,
people, by the way.
This is why we don't send Wetzel to games very often. I think our editors are...
What's going on? Look at this.
The best game of the season is transpiring on the field. He's looking at the upper corner at the band.
How much first half did you write? Okay, your little color-coded whatevers. So the band leaves to go down to the field, but they leave behind like five band members, which I don't understand. What, you didn't make the cut? Like, you're a red shirt clarinet player?
They were theorizing like they were red shirts or something.
Like you made it all.
Was there a big
red
drum?
Yeah, totally
red
stranded.
Shirt trombonist.
Yeah, it's got to do a little more work in spring practice. What is this? You come all the way there and then you don't get to get on the field?
Yeah.
So that sucks.
Work on your high step.
Randomly, and I have a photo of this, randomly there's one extra tuba that is left behind. There's nobody near the tuba. It's just there. It's like one guy in the tuba section just said, I ain't carrying my tuba all the way down and back. I'll just go down there and hide in the bathroom. Maybe no one will know. I don't know what happened. Why was there an extra tuba at the top of Spartan Stadium, Pat? What hat? Where's the, whose tuba was it?
I admit it was a perplexing, captivating mystery. It was. Whose was it? Why was it there? Why was it left there?
Anybody knows, drop me word. Why would there be an extra tuba up there? Where is the tuba? There's a tuba still there. I don't know. I forgot to look as I got the chaos at the end of the game. I didn't pay enough attention when they were leaving.
No tubas left behind.
They left it behind.
Yeah, there might have been
one. I don't blame that guy.
It was left behind for the halftime show.
I'm hauling my tuba all the way down there to play this stupid thing.
You think maybe they play for like a tuba trophy or something?
I think they definitely do. They take the band seriously. Yeah. They take these bands seriously. I don't understand it. I don't know band culture. Do you need like a replacement tuba? Like, the tuba is now the most concerning musical instrument in the Big Ten, other than the Purdue drum, that is also a lie. It's not the giant drum. It's not that giant. Giant, not the world's biggest, though.
I think the tuba player might have busted a positive COVID test.
Yeah, but how did he get up? Yeah, maybe he got up there.
Dan Wetzel, your new business card just going to say investigative Big Ten band reporter.
It's a bunch of frauds in the Midwest. Iowa's lying. Ames is lying. Purdue's lying. Michigan's got the tubas laying all over the damn place. It's a bunch of lies.
Please end
this podcast.
Keeping
them honest.
Please.
Somebody burn a couch. Talk to you later.